Welcome, book lovers, here for Book Circle Online. We're starting a brand new series called Adapted, where we talk about books that have been turned into movies. So it's a very fun show for us. It's a monthly series, so stay tuned as we do The Invention of Hugo Cabret.
This is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
That's right. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who are fans of Popcorn Talk, you will know Marissa Serafini and I from Anatomy of a Movie, where we dissect movies in depth. But we also have a passion for books.
That we do.
And Marissa, in fact, hosts another series here for Book Circle Online. And I said, hey, I want to jump in on this Book Circle Online thing. I like books. So I said, hey, why don't you and I get together? We already have a great rapport. And do something that relates to movies, relates to books. And so we did. We're doing Adapted. And we love it. Each month we will read a book. We'll let you know what the book it is that we're reading. And one that has been adapted into a movie. Mm-hmm. Or several movies.
Or several, yeah. I'm very excited because you love movies. I love movies. You love books. I love books. And, you know, I'm very excited for Book Circle Online. I'm excited for our first one.
And you know what? How fitting that the first one should be one that marries, for me, three loves. I love magic, I love movies, and I love books. And I guess I could say I also love paintings and pictures.
There you go. I love paintings and pictures, I love books, and I love movies. So there you go.
So the book that we're talking about is The Invention of Hugo Cabret. And it's a 2007 novel. It's a historical fiction, fantasy, steampunk type of genre, and that's the book. And it combines all these various things. To give you guys a little context, it's about 500. It's about 530 pages. Over 280 of which are pictures.
Yes, 284. So this book, if you're actually following along, the actual book of The Invention of Hugo Cabret, it's a very thick book. It's also very deceiving. But it's nice when you first open it and read it. It literally takes you 48 to 50 pages just to get to the first page of text. So, like, by the time you actually start reading, it feels like you've accomplished something and, like, read something, even though you're already encapsulated into, like, the pictures and in the story, which I enjoyed.
Yeah, and, you know, as we talk about this in the movie form, you know, I obviously love the movie as well, Hugo, directed by Martin Scorsese. But one of the things that I actually grew to love about the book, there's that great line in there where Hugo and Isabel go to the movies. And, you know, they're looking at movie posters, and she says, sometimes I like seeing the pictures because it allows me to create the story. And one of the, you know, as I was watching the movie, I thought about that quote simply because, you know, now I'm seeing it in moving form, whereas in the book itself, I'm able to kind of expand upon the story itself just through the pictures because I can stay on the picture for as long or short as I want.
Yeah, what I enjoyed about, you know, the movie and also the book shows you just a few pictures of what the characters are seeing, but the movie kind of goes a little bit more in depth of what they're actually seeing, like, in real time, which I really enjoy. And I always do like watching movies that are, like, movies within movies, because that's always fun, to see other characters enjoy movies when you, the audience, are already watching a movie. That's always a fun element to watch.
Absolutely. And we should take a quick step back in the sense of, if you guys, we have a rundown that Marissa and I obviously use, so if you'd like to follow along, in the description box, we'll post the link for you guys to follow along, so that way you guys can follow along as well. And, you know, to a great extent, unlike with Anatomy of a Movie, where we say there's a spoiler alert, yes, there's a spoiler alert that we want to say to you guys, but at the same time, you know, I think with books it's a little bit different in the sense that, you know, I think we can have it won't go as depth into story in the sense of spoiler-filled, but perhaps if you're worried about that, tune out. Go read the book first, then come back to us. But hopefully, nonetheless, if you choose to listen to it, it will just inspire you to read the book even more so. Because that's the, you know, it's dramatic irony in the sense, like, even if you know what's going on, the words and the text, and in this case, the pictures, really come to life.
Mm-hmm. And the great thing about books is that, yes, we can tell like certain story elements or the big key moments of the story, but it's also the beauty of books is that when you read it, you have your own individual interpretation of it. So we can say it, but when once you, the reader, actually reads it, it could be something completely different. You know?
Indeed, that's the fun. So Brian Selznick is the one who wrote it. He grew up in New Jersey, and one of the distinctions for me that I'm speculating that got his love for movies. His grandfather was a cousin of Hollywood producer David O. Selznick. And so, you know, there's that family connection to movies right off the bat. And so I imagine a lot, you know, that spurred his interest somewhat into this arena.
Yeah, and the thing also about Brian is that he didn't really go to school for illustration, or he majored in illustration, but he didn't really expect it'd be illustration for children's books. That wasn't his key, you know, core study, which I found interesting because, like, I personally am very interested in illustration and graphic designing. That's an interest to me. And so he went to school for that, and then he, by the means of, you know, working just, you know, to support himself, he did get a job at a children's book. And from there, that's when he learned children's books. And he had to actually study and learn the knowledge of children illustrations and storylines.
Yeah, Eeyore's Books for Children in New York City is where he worked.
Yeah.
So that's the name of the place. And, you know, to be honest, I mean, one of the fun things, I think, you know, as adults perhaps, and feel free to comment if you agree or disagree, but I get the feeling that sometimes people have this notion that kids' books aren't as in-depth or can't be as meaningful. And in fact, for me, whether it's this book or maybe Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard book, perhaps another book that we'll talk about next time, which we'll tease at the end, you know, there's a sense to it. Like, there's just such fun and adventure that, and I still get the same depths of emotion, if nothing else, as adult books, minus the long, drawn-out words.
Right. No, agreed. I always enjoyed children's books, and even, you know, teenage, the young adult books, because there are a lot of pictures that can transport you into another land and, like, actually use that creative imagination that kids utilize so much more when they're, you know, in their youth than adults do.
Absolutely. And in that respect, too, one of the things that I love about this book is the fact, you know, selfishly, I'm writing a book now, and I look at it in the sense of, okay, what can I utilize? Because I don't want to just do words. And so a book like this, it just inspires you in so many ways because it redefines what a novel can be. Well, why can't you use pictures? Why can't you use this and that to tell the story? And it sort of opens it up, you know, just as a medium in general.
Yeah, I mean, and that also shows, like, it can give you a sense of what you're trying to accomplish in your storylines, and then also gives the audience a sense of, like, their own interpretations of what it could look like.
Yeah, I mean, if I have to just applaud this book, it uses all the elements so well, and the fun part is that it ties its, you know, it utilizes them not only to tell the story, but it also is the story, right? We talked about it there. As Brian describes it, it's not exactly a novel, not quite a picture book, not quite a graphic novel or a flip book or a movie, but a combination of all of these. And, you know, one of the things, we'll talk definitely story, but the fun part about it too, and one of the reasons it got driven to be a movie, is because it has so many filmic elements. And in fact, as we made mention multiple times, it honors movies.
Absolutely. And I think the good thing about this book, because of so many illustrations and pictures that you see, I feel like the use of the pictures in this book, like, helps with the transition of scenes, helps you establish a flashback. There's so many different ways that he uses his pictures to tell his story that still keeps the storyline progressing forward, which I enjoy.
And you did a lot of research in terms of why he wrote this book or what inspired him. So want to give us a little context on that, and then we'll dive into the story specifically.
Yeah, so Brian Zelznick, he really liked magicians, and he liked the old-time silent films, especially like Georges Méliès. And then once he was doing more research about Georges Méliès, he learned that Méliès also was very interested in clockmaking and automatons, which essentially, like, the same principles are also used with magicians, because the sleight of hands and actual the mechanics of how to set up like a big I would say object, or like something when you put it together, the same principles are building something. Mm-hmm. And so Brian, he looked more into that, and then he thought about when he was in London, and the stories of how he learned that there was the story that with all these automatons, that this train station like burned down and a lot of them were destroyed, and he envisioned maybe someone found one of the automatons and tried to save it, and that was like the conception of the character of Hugo. He could be, so how did Hugo get this automaton, and where do you go from there? So that was pretty much the story of how he thought of conceived Hugo.
Interestingly enough, I don't know why, but New Jersey just pumps out people who love magic. David Copperfield is also from from New Jersey, just as a side fact.
There you go.
Nonetheless, the real life story of Georges Méliès, it's so interesting because, you know, it's echoed very almost are accurately within Hugo the book. Couple of changes here and there, as you might expect, but overall the spirit of, you know, of everything that he did is contained within the book, and that's part of what I love about it, was the fact that he was able to do that. In fact, in the movie, there's a line that's where he says, you know, happy endings are only for movies. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing the research, I was like, oh, please let it not just be in the book and the movies that it had a happy ending, but in fact, in real life, things, you know, he had a happy ending where his movies got restored and things of that nature. So the very ending scene of the book and the movie is very much in keeping with what kind of happened in real life as well. So I'm happy for that.
Yeah, I applaud the accuracy. And Brian Zelznick also said he himself did a bunch of research of like the true stories of what Méliès went through his career. And he tried to apply that to the book and to make sure timelines and certain things and situations in life actually did properly, accurately line up historically, you know.
Yeah, and I won't get into, you know, in our rundown, I read not the full history, but just kind of bigger beats of George's life. You know, the slight distinction in real life and what happens in the book. Yes, there's, you know, in the book they cite World War I as the cause of his downcline. In real life, it was more so just the way movies were starting to be distributed. The movie industry was starting to kind of take off in that way. And, you know, he wanted to stay an independent producer, which at the time things were becoming more kind of studio-based and whatnot, believe it or not. Again, very, very early inception of it. But nonetheless, corporations were forming around this and, you know, they wanted to distribute movies differently. He didn't see it that way. And so, unfortunately, that's kind of what started his decline overall.
Which is, you know, really sad, but also historically accurate, too, because it, and also around this time, like, talkies were starting to get invented, and that changed the industry of movies as well, and changed a lot of people's career and how things are distributed and why people went to the movies. And it's sad that, you know, the World War I was, like, a big factor, but also the sad notion that he made so many movies and so many were destroyed, but some were actually restored, which I enjoyed.
Some were. I mean, I remember seeing college, you know, Trip to the Moon.
Same here, yeah.
Classic.
We had to watch that one.
But it's just fun, you know, it's a book like this, maybe in the context of college and that, you know, academia can just have such a, sometimes negative connotation because it's almost like you're required to learn this, mm-hmm. as opposed to this just brings out the joy of it. And so it took on a whole new meaning when I saw it in this context, obviously.
Yeah, and you know, I actually recently rewatched A Trip to the Moon, and watching it now with more film knowledge that I have since film school, it's interesting because especially back in the time that Méliès actually created the film, not a lot of people were doing what he was doing. They having the visual that he had, the production value, and going to the moon. This was decades before we actually physically put someone on the moon, so like he already had that thought, and the fact that he added color to film, which was not a common thing back then. He did a lot of revolutionary things, quote unquote, especially back in that time.
Well, think about it, you know, Jules Verne, and he's made mention of within the books themselves. You know, he kind of pioneered technology in that way. Or at least the thought of it. And then, you know, he took it to, like, the movie that we're talking about, 1902. Mm-hmm. That's over 100 years old. For a medium that is not that old, no. Contextually, you know, in comparison to books and everything else. So, you know, 1902, he was doing stuff that, the fact that we can still watch it, and yes, it's not, you know, you're not watching a Marvel CGI movie, but the fact that it still overall holds up is insane.
It certainly does, and the fun thing about it is, like, it is a silent film, so you're really just watching the visual aspect of it, and it's fun seeing everyone together, how the visual looks of it, and, you know, the graininess, the fact that it is film, and you can see all the hard cuts that they did because it's film. I really enjoyed it, and you saw this process of how they built this capsule and shot it to the moon, and then once they were at the moon, all the crazy things and creatures that they interacted with on the moon, it's an actually pretty neat film for being only about 15 minutes long.
And yeah, I mean, some of the things that he was known for, the special effects that we talked about, substitution slices, so if you watch the movie of Hugo, you can see them do that, but it's essentially, like, for example, they were trying to catch somebody and then smoke would come up and then the person would disappear, so that they would slice the two things together. So he's known for that. Multiple exposures, time-lapse photography, dissolves, and as you mentioned, hand-painted color.
Yeah.
So very, very revolutionary at the time. But let's pause on him for a moment and let's, you know, if you had to describe the story of Hugo, how would you describe it? And I guess another way to state that, if you want, is what is the theme and what do you come away feeling?
I would explain to someone who's never seen or read the story is, like, it's a boy who's trying to fix something to explain the answers and get closer to his father, but also learning more about himself. Also, like, he is an orphan boy, but I don't think it really matters because I think it's more of that self-discovery of who his father is and, like, that creating relationships and something was bringing up the past. Those themes of family and history and learning from it, I enjoyed.
I agree with you. For me, more specifically, it's about sort of this connection through imagination and through everything else, through work, that we're able to have, you know, two human beings. And how, in a sense, like you made mention, right, the idea of fixing something, we all think that perhaps we need to be fixed, but not in the ways that we initially might expect or going after, and out of that, if we open ourselves up to the glorious wonders of, you know, just life in general, if you will, incredible things can happen.
Absolutely. And I think the great thing about this book is that children can enjoy it, adults can enjoy it. There's really not a specific demographic that this book could be geared to. Yes, it is technically a children's book, but we're adults reading it, and we both enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Because, again, going to that notion, I think, like, just the characters themselves and their interactions are just very authentic. I think that's a key component, and in some sense, it's like what really Puff the Magic Dragon really is about is losing your imagination. And, you know, for adults, it takes on a different meaning because you look at something like this and you look at the character of George's, you know, he very much represents someone who's lost his inspiration, his perhaps not will to necessarily live, but just will to keep going and to keep fighting. And perhaps, especially in this day and age, an adult can read that and see themselves very much in that same position and perhaps be re-inspired.
Yeah, it's very relatable, and I think that's what kids can learn from it and what adults can take away from it. Like, sometimes it is hard to dredge up your past, but also knowing and facing your past, that's where you can actually maybe face it, heal, and move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things symbolically in the book, they didn't quite touch upon it in the movie, which I thought was fine, but the idea of Prometheus.
Mm-hmm.
I love that idea that, you know, here's an entity and he sort of creates humankind, but he wants them to have the tools and the means, you know, he wants them to still be able to have the things of the gods, if you will. And so he throws them things every now and then. And, you know, I just love the symbolism of that, you know, because, and then in the book, the cliffhanger that, oh, he was punished for what he did, being Prometheus. And then, yeah, just that line, like when he says to Hugo, don't worry, Prometheus was, he was let go, or whatever it ultimately ended up.
Yeah, he was let go at the end. Well, like, I enjoyed the symbolism of Prometheus, too, because that's something, like, with the story of Prometheus, you know, it's because of your immortality, you have to suffer. And I feel like Georges Méliès might have gone through that a little bit. Like, his film literally will last lifetimes. And, I mean, it has last lifetimes. So we're still talking about it. So, you know, there is some immortality to his work. But now knowing what he suffered and went through, you can take away from that and see the symbolisms and the parallelisms between Prometheus and Georges Méliès.
Absolutely. One of the things I do want to talk about, the relationship between Isabel and Hugo, because it's a very strong relationship. And it's slightly, we'll talk about the differences between the movie version of it and the book version of it. But so let's talk specifically, you know, how you felt about the relationship in the book.
In the book, I thought it was an interesting, it's nice to pair a girl and a boy together, especially at a young age, because you can, you know, you have that companionship and you can play off of each other. I felt a lot of tension and animosity between these two, for some reason, and they are kids, which they eventually, like, you know, near the end, they do develop a good, strong friendship, but it started off on a rocky road.
Yeah, I enjoyed the tension, because they're, from the book's perspective, they're both trying to figure out each other's motives, and part of Hugo's motive is the fact that he needs to remain secretive about the various thing that he's up to because it could destroy his livelihood, if you will. You know, there's distinctions. You know, I think in the movie they make him seem a lot more friendly or a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
Even so much that when the automaton first draws a trip to the moon, that famous picture, they very much go and see it together. Whereas in the book, and again, it's a different choice, and I thought it worked well. The choices that were made for the movie and the book worked well for each. Because in the book, I did enjoy the fact that there was that animosity of, like, how did you find my workstation? And then they end up ripping, mm-hmm. unfortunately, the drawing that is made.
Yeah, and I was just trying to question in the book, like, why Hugo is so distant. And, like, I understand that he lost his family, he lost his father and his uncle. He really is alone, so he's fending for himself. But I was just questioning why the girl was, you know, because she has this family, but she was very resistant and somewhat dismissive to Hugo, which was surprising from being a girl. Usually the women, or, you know, little girls are more empathetic towards and more emotionally inclined towards people. And I was just really kind of surprised why she was so dismissive right off the bat.
I'll speak to the first point because I can't quite fully speak to the second point. Maybe it'll come to me. But in terms of Hugo, you have to also understand that, you know, he's, as an orphan, he has to be very careful because he knows he would get sent to the orphanage. And the movie does a little bit better of a job with it because they illustrate that through another orphan that gets caught by the station inspector.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you know, though Isabel's intentions might be pure, he has to be very careful because nonetheless, if she exposes him in any sort of way, whether she wants to or not, there's a repercussion to that where, you know, he's going to be thrown into an orphanage and something obviously that he doesn't want. Certainly not at the moment. So that's why I think he's coming at it from where he's coming at it from.
Yeah, understandable. I do enjoy the fact that, you know, because they kind of butted heads at the beginning, you can see that slow progression throughout the story that they're finally learning more about each other. They're helping each other, especially once we get to the key scene. You can see that Isabel is actually, like, very interested in what Hugo's doing, and then she's really along for the ride.
Let me ask you this. Why? It was broken up. The book was broken up into parts. Which is fine, but I didn't necessarily see a need for it, if you will.
Yeah, me neither. There's part one and part two, and at the end of part one, he finally got the automaton just working, yeah. Which I enjoyed. And in the movie, that's really the first 45 minutes.
Yeah, the halves are not quite the same.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe from a... Technically, because this is a children's book, if parents are reading this to kids, that would be a good point to stop, mm-hmm. For a break for children. But if you do break it up in the one, two parts, you can make, like, two in an episodic kind of feature, franchise it a little bit. Not that's terrible with our industry always making franchises of everything, but that's, like, it's a good splitting point between the two, because it felt like, one, the first half was about really just getting the automaton working and establishing mm-hmm. the characters, and two is now learning why and where did the automaton come from
and what's the connection to Papa.
Yes.
Papa Joseph. Absolutely. Again, from my perspective, I didn't necessarily need it. I mean, a good enough stopping point is the next chapter for me, always.
Yeah, or the next picture. There's hundreds of them.
But nonetheless, I do want to talk about, I'm going to butcher his name.
Etienne.
Because he does not appear in the movie. And so I wanted to kind of, from the book perspective, I liked him because he was just such a, I don't know why, in terms of what you were talking about, Isabel and Hugo, if Isabel's a little bit more standoffish, here he comes, and he's just like, great, whatever, come to the movies, you're in. Oh, you need this? All right, I got you. Oh, you want that book? I'll give you some money.
Right, like, I really liked Etienne because in the book, he's that male companion that Hugo so needs in his life. I mean, he doesn't have a male figure. And the fact that Etienne, he is younger, he is a college student, so he's younger and closer to the age of Hugo, and he's still that character that's just fun, and he inspires Hugo. Like, he gets him to the movie theaters and breaks him in, and, like, he really... It feels like Etienne is the catalyst to why Hugo's doing everything. Mm-hmm. The movies, and then the introduction of magic, and got Hugo's interest in, like, oh, this is why magicians like clockmaking and the automatons. Like, Etienne really started Hugo off kind of on his journey.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in the movie, I think they kind of combined that into the father role just in general, and... into other and lesser parts into other characters.
Yeah, in the book, Etienne is his own character, but I felt in the movie they kind of split it between the father and also Tobar.
Mm-hmm.
Because Tobar's just like another person that's already at the university, so maybe kind of cut out the middleman, which is Etienne.
Yeah. And also, too, I would venture to say the Christopher Lee character in the movie, they kind of put it on him. He's the bookshop owner.
Yeah.
I forget. Monsieur L, I believe is his name. Any other elements from the book that stood out to you that you want to discuss that you rather enjoy?
I liked how the book, and I think the movie does it as well, but the book really establishes that train station that Hugo lives in, and it is its own world and a character of it in itself. And as you see in the pictures, like the scope and the actual, you know, scale of him going through the tunnels, and he knows like literally the ins and outs of the train station, and it is his home. And I felt it was really fascinating to follow Hugo throughout this whole story, throughout the train station.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at it almost like it's just a map. You know, a very detailed map. And so, you know, when one of the things that we're going to talk about is, okay, what might have drawn someone to make the movie? And you can call it, okay, for lack of a better term, what are the filmic elements of the book that people know will translate well? When you look at this, as you mentioned, the train station. Also, there's the parts where the train crashes or things like that. Hanging from Clocks, which is a callback to Safety Last. That's a movie from 1923.
Harold Lloyd.
Yes, indeed. You know, the running through tunnels, the running through the clocks, and everything like that. And even just the smaller moments that we get of Paris life. In general, we get that great kind of drawing of the Eiffel Tower, and then we eventually enter into the train station itself. So it just lends itself so nicely to be filmed.
Oh yeah, especially, and it really plays off of the imagination as well. I feel like the film does a good job of, you know, the crashing through the train crash. That was a real thing, and the fact that they kind of incorporated it into the film as a nightmare that Hugo goes through because he knows about it. I enjoyed that they actually showed it in the newer sense. And then hanging from the clock face, it still kind of ties to what Hugo was going through, like running away from the station inspector. I visually, this movie was gorgeous, and Hugo, like Scorsese, like he purposely filmed it for that 3D element. And there are moments in the film where you can clearly tell if you actually were watching it in proper 3D, it looked beautiful on screen.
Yeah, I mean, so as we sort of jump to the adaptation of it, GK Films acquired the rights to the book shortly after it was published. And John Logan was contracted to write the screenplay. It took a while to, you know, the movie itself didn't come out until 2011, so it was quite a while through the development process itself. But yeah, of all people, you know, Scorsese, known for his gangster films, if you will, you know, one of the reasons that, and he's talked about that, like, he just has such a love of cinema. The movies that this guy knows, even though it's sort of not his genre, you understand why he would be drawn to make this movie in particular.
Absolutely. And like I said earlier, like, this film is a film within a film. Talking about and showing and, you know, showcasing Méliès' career and showing that on film, what that would look like and what Méliès went through, the production aspect. You saw a moment where he's actually, you saw the whole production crew putting a trip to the moon together. That's cool, because we've only seen the actual film. We don't know what it's like actually putting it together, and I think Scorsese did a great job of showcasing that. And there was like moments where, like, when, not to jump ahead, but when the papers are flying all over across the screen, once they finally get the, you know, they broke the armoire.
Yeah.
And the papers are flying. Like, that was a simple thing in the book, but in the film, they, like, really showed the different pictures flying at you at screen in 3D format. I thought that was a nice visual element that they really escalated.
Yeah, what I thought, you know, what was fun for me was, in terms of the book, I was able to breeze through the book very fast, and as I mentioned, I would stop it. Like, when I got to the text, I would read through the text very fast because, you know, it's very easy to read and I want to get to the next thing. When it came time for the pictures, I would slow down my pace and because I wanted to take mm-hmm. that in a little bit more. What the movie for me does really well is it has very good pacing. And even though, obviously, you don't necessarily get to pause unless you want to, you know, the movie keeps moving at its own pace and you have to kind of follow that along, but at the same time you get the timing of which you get to absorb this stuff I thought was matched very perfectly.
Yeah, and the book, the first part one is the first 45 minutes of the movie, and I felt like the pacing was still fine, but I felt the movie did slow down near the middle, especially once we got to the reveal of who George was, and then we were explaining and showing his whole career and what he went through putting all the films together. I enjoy that because that is that production process that I personally just love watching.
That's the part. So originally the movie was slated for $100 million, and then it ballooned into about $170 million. So I imagine the ballooning aspect of it had a lot to do with shooting these mini movies within the movie.
Yes.
But I'm glad they did, because that, yeah, you know, I think what the movie does well is highlights those a little bit more. Like, the book in general is a ton of fun, and I get a lot out of it. But that specifically of really seeing that, as you made mention, I'm glad, if nothing else, the movie was made for that reason.
Absolutely. And it also introduces people who aren't familiar with Georges Méliès' work, especially because so much of it was lost. And the fact that they're showing... In the book, you see one picture, maybe every, like, a few movies that he did, but in the movie, they actually showed the mini-movies. So it's kind of like a small film festival within itself.
Absolutely. And one of the things, too, that I did enjoy about the movie is that it was able to play with the voyeuristic elements of the train station a little bit more. You know, the station manager is a little bit more developed, and Monsieur and Madame of the bakery, their relationship develops a lot more. And, you know, sometimes it's just kind of there. Other times, you know, you can see Hugo directly... I mean, being at a train station, that must be the best people watching you can get.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, public places like that. And you mentioned the voyeuristic aspect. You definitely visually saw how Hugo was watching people from his different vantage points within the station. You get a sense of him looking behind clocks and peepholes here and there. But, like, everywhere that Hugo turned in the movie, he could see, like, every aspect of the train station.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I don't know, okay, maybe that's not a big deal, but I felt it slightly cheated on Isabella's behalf was the fact that Hugo understands how to pick locks in the movie, whereas in the book, he needs her very much to pick the locks because he doesn't know how.
Yeah, I didn't really mind the change because Hugo he knows clocks, he knows gears. It makes sense that his character would know how to pick a lock. But in the book, it kind of shows that Isabel's character is a little bit more daring, a little bit more adventurous, and that's what Hugo need. And I think in the movie, there's a line like, now you know we're on an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
But like I enjoyed it either way. It didn't really change the story at all.
Part of, and you know, I think there's so much magic in the movie, but part of what also did stand out to me in the book in particular was the notion, and the movie just does this in a different way, how Papa George, he kind of gets Hugo going on his own. He sees something within Hugo, and obviously he doesn't explain it, but he's punishing him through having him clean the store and fixing the various things. but he sees himself obviously within Hugo, and so much so that he inspires him. Like in the book, he's doing his various card tricks, which leads Hugo to want to do the same and explore and learn.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that element. Again, I think the movie made up for it, but nonetheless, I really enjoyed that as part of the book that just wasn't in the movie.
Yeah, I felt like the first half really established Hugo as a clock inventor, like as someone who can fix clocks, knows gears, knows parts very well, and knows how something is as complicated and intricate as an automaton. I believe the character could fix it. In the movie, not so much. That is just something he kind of tinkered with, but not something he actually studied like he did in the first part of the book.
Mm-hmm. Another differentiation was that Isabel had never seen a movie. In the movie, she had never seen a movie.
But it kind of makes sense if she was raised by George, Papa George, who completely cut it out of his life. He translated to Isabel, so it makes sense that she grew up having maybe the sense that movies were forbidden in the house.
Yeah. Well, that's where, how do you say his name again?
Etienne.
Because he's not part of the movie, he's the one who would sneak her in, because she wouldn't get money from her godparents to go to the movies, so therefore she was snuck in, and that's how her love of movies in the book came about. If you eliminate that character, she essentially can't go to the movie, so it makes sense for the Hugo the movie.
Yes, it did. But I liked it because also the fact that like she enjoys movies also makes her character help Hugo along for along the ride, and like she's encouraging him to put this automaton together, learn more about her own godparents.
Yeah, and you know what I do also enjoy, right? If you're an adult, we talked about adults reading the book, but if you're an adult watching the movie, it kind of brings you back to the joy of why you fell in love with movies the first time, because you know at a certain point you might start to get jaded. Especially perhaps now with so many of these superhero movies, you're like, oh, all the movies are the same. But, you know, nonetheless, it just reminds you, like, yes, that might be a couple of the movies, but movies in general, if you really, like, that's what got you to love movies, certainly for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always watched movies and read books as a kid, and knowing that Isabel didn't really have that growing up, that's a sad, sad realization. So I'm glad that, like, at a young age, she was, like, instilled upon, like, how great movies are and, like, how they can transport you into a different world and use that creative imagination. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Any other distinctions that you saw between the book and the movie?
I wish we could have seen Hugo working on the automaton a little bit more. In the movie, it's pretty much already well-placed, already put together. It's just missing the key. I would have actually liked to see the process of Hugo trying to actually fix it.
One of the things that I did like about the movie, and even, you know, I saw the movie when it first came out, but I had forgotten the finer details. As I was reading the book, in the book, the key kind of comes out of nowhere. And he knows why he needs it, and then it opens up that mystery. But I like in the movie, you know, I knew movie-wise, when I would go to rewatch it, that the key visually would have to be foreshadowed in the movie. Like, you can't really get around it, and so I'm glad that they were able to foreshadow it, and then he sees it on her necklace. He's like, I need that!
Yeah, and they showed it. And also, because in the book, this is where, like, there's still tension between these two, because Hugo steals the key, not properly ask Isabel for the key.
Mm-hmm.
And because he steals it, Isabel, like, clearly attacks him. So I liked how the movie made it more friendly. Be like, oh, I need that. Can I borrow it, please? Here, I'll show you what I need it for. That, I didn't really mind that change.
Yeah. And I also, I did like Christopher Lee's character as the bookstore owner, you know, where he gives him Robin Hood. Something that wasn't in the book. So, I just enjoyed, while we lost a character, quite a somewhat major one from the book, the other ones were able to be fleshed out, and I enjoyed that part of it.
Yeah, I mean, even Lizette, and I think Emily Mortimer, she's a great actress, too. So it was nice seeing, like, all these actors, all their characters, you know, be enhanced a bit, especially the train station inspector.
Yeah, he was made an orphan, which in the book you don't really know that at all.
Right, no. And in the book I feel like the train station, the inspector's only there for maybe two or three moments, and in the movie, like, he's a looming threat that kind of carries throughout the whole film, which I enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, what works for the book, which wouldn't have worked, you can get into Hugo's head, and so even though we don't interact with the station inspector, he's mentally a threat throughout, even if he's not a physical threat. And so for a movie, you have to translate that mental threat to a physical threat. And so, and the fact that they were able to utilize that then, and not just put him in there, but also develop a storyline that, you know, here he is, loves the girl, he himself is an orphan, and, you know, by the end you do feel bad for him. You're like, oh, you, yeah. Orphans need to learn that families aren't necessary and all that, and you're like, oh, you poor sad man.
Oh yeah, he just needs love in his life. I enjoyed that they actually gave the character more to do in the movie, and also, like, I think because they had Sacha Baron Cohen, he is a bigger name who can draw a bigger crowd. I feel that could have been a reason why they made his character bigger. Also, in the book, there's no dog that's chasing Hugo. It's just the inspector. And in the movie, there's also the inspector and the dog constantly running through the train station. So I feel like the added threat of a dog chasing you and hunting you down, that's also scary.
Yeah, and, you know, in its unique way, you know, you could make criticism of the movie and call it hokey, but everyone gets a happy ending. So, you know, part of the reason for having the dog is that his leg is messed up from World War I, right? Mm-hmm. But at the end, not only does he get the girl, Hugo also makes him this amazing brace that doesn't squeak, that doesn't lock up, and he's all happy. That's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah, because at the beginning of, you know, the story, those two are at each other. They're like, well, is really the inspector gunning it for Hugo, but the fact that they build a relationship and friendship at the end shows character arc within both of them.
Absolutely. Here's a quote by Robert Ebert that I think encompasses why Scorsese did the movie and just in general of the movie and the book that I feel. So, quote, "He goes, unlike any other film Martin Scorsese has ever made, and yet possibly the closest to his heart. A big-budget family epic in 3D, and in some ways a mirror of his own life. We feel a great artist has been given command of the tools and the resources he needs to make a movie about movies."
Movies. Movie within a movie.
So absolutely, you know. And, you know, I mentioned this quote a little bit earlier, but one of the things that I loved about, you know, life is like the movies.
It definitely is.
And, you know, it's just a matter of perspective and just have, you know, thought, if you will, and what a state of mind, whatever you want to call it. But you can have a happy ending, too.
Yeah. And I'm glad that the story all had a happy endings. So.
Indeed. So, and as we made mention, it translated so well. In terms of accolades for the movie, you know, it was nominated 11 times for the Academy Awards, including Best Picture. It didn't go on to win that. It did win Best Cinematography, Best Art Direction, Best Sound Mixing, Best Sound Editing, and Best Visual Effects. So, all very deserving. You know, and I'm glad it just got considered. And Scorsese did win a Golden Globe for directing. So, a lot of praise there. And I think, believe it or not, you know, I don't know, like, when people think of Scorsese, like, I think people in some sense forgot a little bit about Hugo the movie. Mm-hmm. But I think in time, when Scorsese's body of work is complete, people will actually look back to that movie more so.
Yeah, I feel like this movie is more timeless than all of his other films that he's done. This movie is geared to a bigger, wider demographic than his usual films are. And I think this one is more enjoyable. There's not really a lot of cursing like most of his movies is. It's a pleasant movie to watch for Scorsese, and he usually has long movies. for me personally, Scorsese's kind of like a hit or miss, but this movie is definitely a hit, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it when it first came out. It was gorgeous. I went out and bought it, you know, when it first came out. It's a beautiful film.
Yeah, and one of the fun things, you know, there might be some adaptations of movies that we talk about that don't do a service to the book as much, and we'll say that the book is way better, or conversely, it might be the other way, which, ironically, if we ever do The Prestige, I think that's a fun one where I think the movie's actually better than the book, to be honest with you. But
Prestige is a great film.
But nonetheless, I think what's great about this, the original source material, that being the book, is fantastic, but the movie also does it an amazing service, and sometimes that's a very rare thing to get both on that same level.
Yeah, and I'm glad the movie had accolades, and the book also had accolades. Brian Zelsnick won the 2008 Caldecott Medal for this particular book. It won the National Book Award. It was a National Book Award finalist, New York Times Best Illustrated Book of 2007, Publishers Weekly Best Book, the 2007 Quill Award winner, 2007 Borders Original Voices finalist. There's a lot of awards.
#RIP Borders.
Yeah. Oh, I miss Borders. But another bookstore that's still around, Barnes & Nobles. This was also 2007's number one best book for kids for Barnes & Nobles. So this book came out, it received high praise as well.
Absolutely. So overall, there you have it. We encourage you to see, obviously, not only the movie, but also to read the book. And if you're like me, I encourage you to get it from your local library.
And if you're like me, you can just go buy it.
Both options are good.
Yes.
Just don't steal it.
No, don't be a thief. Don't be a Hugo. Don't be a thief.
All right, Marissa, shall we tease what we've got coming up next month?
Yes. So our next adapted book, we're planning on doing The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling, published in 1894. Classic story, classic movie that was made off of it.
Classic movies.
There's several movies based off of it. But yeah, we're doing The Jungle Book. If you don't know the story, I highly suggest you read it so you do.
Absolutely. So we're going to do that one. And if you want, obviously, please do read the book. Additionally, we encourage you to see not only the animated Disney movie, but also the live-action movie. For me, I also enjoy the 1994 other live-action movie before the new live-action movie came out. I actually think that one's a lot of fun. It's a little bit different than the book. But I actually enjoy it quite a lot. And then there's another movie that I didn't even know that existed. A 1984 version, Marissa?
A 1984 version.
So I'll have to see that one. So plenty of Jungle Book adaptations to talk about, and we'll talk about them all as well, as well as the book. So look out for that. Also, let us know what books you'd like us to... What books... They have been turned into movies, so we can't just do any book.
Adapted.
But let us know any suggestions that you'd like us to take on after The Jungle Book, and we'll highly consider it. And in fact, as of now, Marissa, I might be leaning towards The Prestige.
Oh.
Because I think that'll be fun for you.
That would be good.
It's certainly going to be fun for me. If you guys disagree, then let us know.
It's a great film, so I'd be excited for it.
So there you have it. Any final thoughts before we wrap this up, Marissa?
I enjoyed Hugo. If you haven't read Hugo, now hopefully we did a good job of inspiring you to go read it. And it's a good story. I'm really excited for the show because you love movies and books. I love movies and books, and hopefully you guys do too.
Yeah, and you know, let us know too what you thought. This is our first episode, so let us know what you guys thought worked well. What maybe you'd like to see changed up a little bit. We're not. We're of the ilk where we're happy to make changes and cater to you guys what you guys want most. You know, we might play around with the format ourselves as well to test out new things. Who knows? That's the fun part for us. We like to grow and develop along with you guys and so forth. So, nonetheless, this has been fun for us. At Serafini TV for Marissa.
That's right.
Just go to philsvitek.com. You can get all my stuff there.
And you can get all of our stuff for a rundown. There's also good links and references to the Brian Zelsnick's interview, and you can learn more about him and the book as well.
Absolutely. So definitely check that out. And another show that Marissa and I host together is called Anatomy of Movies. So if you love the movies, every week we generally discuss two movies, if not definitely one, of the latest movies that have come out in theaters. It's a lot of fun for us. It's not your typical review show. It's very much in-depth. Mm-hmm. We also talk about the production side of things, so definitely check that out. It's called Anatomy of a Movie. Marissa, what's the name of your series here on Book Circle?
On Book Circle 9, I cover the When Calls the Heart series by Jeanette Oak. And we have a couple more books down the line that we're going to be talking about. So it covers the Canadian West. Mounties in the Canadian West.
There you go. So there you have it. Thank you guys for joining us. We'll see you next time with the Jungle Book. Until then, just keep reading. It's a fun activity that hopefully you guys all enjoy. And keep spreading the love of books everywhere. Books aren't dead. Bye.
Bye.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO, join the circle.